Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executive After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. Today's episode, I had the pleasure to talk with Mr. Doug Krug. Doug is from the Institute for Unlearning out of Denver, Colorado, and the author of The Missing Piece in Leadership, How to Create the Future You Want. It's in its second print. Doug, the way I would describe Doug is that if you think about a winter afternoon next to a fire and you wanted to read about somebody, you would read about Doug. Doug's life is, not only is he kind and generous, but his life is amazing. Everything Doug learned from leadership, he learned from training dogs in the military. Doug then moves to Denver, opens a record store, becomes successful, buys a hotel, sells it for 120 days later, made more money in that transaction than he did the previous 3 years, and the rest is history. So enjoy today's episode with Doug Krug. I also want to say thank you to my content partner, C-Suite Radio, and Engage Me Online Magazine. It's the place you go to learn everything you want to learn about employee engagement. Quick update about the book, almost done with the first draft, and I'm really excited about it. Definitely in my voice, in my tone, my sarcasm, and my self-deprecation. But it's all about authentic leadership, so there's a positive side. And the model is awesome. So, all right, stay tuned today for today's episode. Mr. Doug Krug, remember, subscribe, leave a review on iTunes. See you!
Well, and what you may be in for, well, I didn't know there was a box, let alone that whether or not I fit into it. And don't know, but the title I use for my work is Resultant.
Yeah.
Not consultant.
I like that. I was reading that on your website.
And the Institute for Unlearning website?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, good.
Good. Where did that name come from?
Well, it came from I have a business partner, and her words were that the four-letter word in my vocabulary is PLAN, that when I work with an executive team, I start with how it's going to end, and then I guide the process from the present to getting there. Mm-hmm. And what that looks like hardly ever looks the same twice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge distinction versus someone who comes in with the answers. The fundamental belief of my work is that, well, it's a chapter in the latest book, and I saved it. It was the title I had for the first book 25 years ago. But the publisher said it was too long. And here's the title. Why pay someone else to tell your people what they already know?
I think your publisher was right. That is too long of a title, but it's good.
Well,
for
it is.
But it's an important. Yeah, it's really important.
But the concept, yes, and have never been anywhere in the full expanse of the people that I've worked with. Mm-hmm. Everything from governor's cabinets to two brothers in a small construction company.
So wait, I still don't understand how you got the Unlearning Institute. Like, where did that come from?
It just flowed out that there's nothing new to learn. It's more unlearning, getting out of the habits, getting out of what we think it is, mm-hmm. to discover what it really is. another term I like to use is that one of the big challenges that I feel leaders are facing today is navigating the space between the no longer and the not yet.
The space is getting smaller and smaller too.
Well, and it's because it's moving faster and faster.
Yeah.
And that's one of the challenges. Most people who got to where they are in organizations got there because they had it figured out. Mm. They knew how to do what needed to be done. The challenge today is that maybe nothing that we've ever done in the past is the right thing to do here to get us to where we want to be. Mm. And that's the challenge.
Well, I also think there's probably a level of flexibility that has to be in the organization and with the individuals in the organization to respond to where the market is taking them. Or if they want, they can also then try to decide they want to drive the market in a new direction. But you got to have flexibility. And especially, I would imagine, the bigger the companies you go to, the more rigid they become.
I've experienced just as rigid and smaller companies and just as much openness in larger ones.
So why is that? Why is that in the smaller ones? Like a controlling attitude?
One of the things that I do as a side, I'll give you a little example. Tell me if this helps. I coach entrepreneurs on making presentations to get funding for their vision, mm-hmm. And the first thing that my suggestion is that they begin their presentation with potential investors with one question. The question is, what are the two or three most important questions for you to get answered by my presentation today? Typically, what happens is the entrepreneur gets in there to tell the potential investor everything there is to know about their idea.
Yeah.
And with no connection as to whether or not the term that I've come up with, and this will help perhaps with the unlearning, the concept, the leader of the team that just got the Federal Employee of the Year award, using my work, working with hospitals to reduce errors in patient errors for mm-hmm. seniors. Mm-hmm. They reduced in 4 years, 2.1 million
wow.
injuries, harms, 87,000 lives saved, and 20 billion in cost savings.
Holy
in
cow.
4 years. Using this simple approach that they call the signature style. My work has a name in DC. In Health and Human Services and Medicare. I didn't make the name up. But here's the term now. It's managing the listening you're speaking into.
Unpack that for me. What does that mean?
It means that the quality of the words being said is so far down the line in importance. It's how those words are heard. So if someone goes in to, like, again, back to the entrepreneur, but any leader who gets up to tell people something, those words are filtered by their people. And if you're not speaking the language that can be heard, mm-hmm. then it doesn't matter how good the information is you have. And so you have to communicate it in a way. I just got one of the greatest acknowledgments in the 30 years I've been doing this. And it was a management team in a really up-and-coming company, and they were all millennials. And I got a standing ovation. And as you can see in the video, I left my millennial years behind quite a bit back. Yeah. But why? Because I didn't stand up there to lecture to them. Mm-hmm. I guided them through a process that caused them to look differently at things.
Okay, so again, so you're taking me down this path, but I want to really back up, because the reality is that Doug doesn't end up here. So per your method, right? We're at where you're at now, but I want to know is where you came from, right? So what are the bricks in your foundation that gets you to this point in your life? So where are you originally from?
Originally from, I was raised in Miami, Florida.
I don't see you as a Miami person, but you might have been in Denver or Colorado for a very long time at this point.
47 years.
So is that where you were raised then? Your whole life was in Miami until you went to university, or did you go to university?
No, I'm unhindered by an education.
Ah, I love it. I was just listening to a podcast today, and they were talking about the concept of education to almost kind of what you were saying earlier. It teaches us a certain set structure, steps to do things. And you almost, what you're saying is that that's pointless in some ways, because they might be teaching you the wrong thing. That's the unlearned part. But before we jump down that path again, because I know you love talking about this stuff, I can tell you live and breathe it, which is awesome, is what was it like growing up in Miami back in the 70s, 60s, 50s, 80s?
You're so kind. Flattery will get you nowhere, but thanks. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to keep trying to use it, though. Someday it will.
Yes. I was just a typical kid, mm-hmm. you know, growing up, and left, joined the military.
Which branch?
That was my escape. And the escape was to get out of the house I was raised in. Mm-hmm. And
not a good environment, it sounds like.
It's taken thousands of dollars and a lot of time to get to the point of realization that my parents did the best they could with what they knew at the time.
That is exactly what I say about my parents. Exactly.
But the impact on me growing up in that environment was not good. And mm-hmm. I went from there to the Air Force and was stationed in Germany. That's where I wanted mm-hmm. to go, because it was German heritage. My father was German. Mm-hmm. And then everything I learned about leadership, I learned from a dog.
Clearly the follow-up question will be, what?
Told you. You asked if I was ready for this. I'm asking.
No,
are you?
I love it. I love it. So wait though, because you know, I like to unpack this. You know, you're pretty far removed from your childhood at this point, and so you know, I grew up in a house where I joke we were an Irish Catholic family without really the Catholicism and a touch of violence to go with it, and so you know, it wasn't like excessive, but when you were in trouble, physical was the option. In terms of the discipline choice, you know, and it's in today's world, is that the same as you? It sounds like, yeah.
Yeah. And it wasn't, it was more emotional abuse and nastiness.
I feel like that's worse than physical.
If the term I probably heard most in growing up, I thought my middle name had to be stupid because that's how I was referred to. Most of the time, and that you'll never amount to anything was the expression that was, you know, part of almost anything that was said to me. It was coached in those terms. Yeah. You'll never amount to anything.
Is that one of the reasons why you just decided not to go to college? Because – so let me tell you my history, because it will make more sense when I ask this question. So when I went to university, my parents were just happy I applied to a college. And the only reason why I applied to a college is because I played sports. And so I thought that was my only way out. And so my mom's theory with education was just try as hard as you can. C's are great. A's probably aren't going to be attainable. So like just bare minimum. My mom and dad were great. I mean, they didn't say you were stupid or anything like that. They never used that vernacular, which I think is almost more harmful. But they, you know, I have a PhD now, and I'm probably the last person you would think of with a PhD because I'm not really an academic person. But I was so hell-bent on proving everybody wrong about what I could and could not do intellectually that became my drive in my late 20s, early 30s. And so the reason why I asked that is that my mom blatantly said, I didn't think you would actually ever go to college. So like that was kind of like, you know, I'm like, all right, well, thanks for the pep talk and the, yes. the support. and she didn't say it in a mean way. She was just kind of like, I just never thought you'd go to college. You know, I didn't think you were the college type. So that was my question, was like, was it all those messages you heard growing up that kind of made you feel like, well, in higher education wasn't my choice? Or was it?
Oh, no.
Just get out.
No, it was there. We were a poor family. Mm-hmm. Furniture. I remember growing up with the furniture being because Florida, South Florida, yeah. peach crates and orange crates pushed together, and grandma crocheted things to cover them. You know, the end tables at the end of a couch were peach crates turned up and then covered with something that was either crocheted or quilted so that it looked like furniture. So there was never even a question as to whether or not college was an option. And so my path out all come together was the military. And so I get to Germany, and in this big open bay, about 20 people, you know, with stacked bunks in big rows, the sharpest looking people had these orange ascots, and their boots were blossomed and very well shined, and they were canine. And so I decided that I liked that look, that I would join canine. And here's the part of everything I learned from a dog about leadership, was they assigned me a dog. And what I spent about a week, maybe as much as 10 days doing, was sitting on the outside of this 10-foot by 10-foot square with a doghouse on stilts and this ferocious German shepherd. I would read letters out loud to it. I would write letters out loud. I would read books out loud. It took that long before I could even pet the dog that was assigned to me. Now, here's where the learning started. The trainer then comes up.
Can I ask you though, while you're doing that, were you instructed to do that, or was that a choice you made? The reading, no, the writing?
Well, it wasn't maybe specific, but it said you have to create a relationship with the dog you're assigned to. And it was real obvious that I wasn't going to be petting that dog when it was first assigned to.
So what made you decide to go that route versus like food?
Because, other food? Oh, no. Other people that had done the same, other canine handlers. That was the path that was shared. So, and thanks. Nobody's ever asked that question. So, thanks. So finally, the trainer comes and says, okay, it's time to start your training. Put this muzzle on your dog. And I said, well, we're friends now. And he says, no, put the muzzle on the dog. And there was no question. I put the muzzle on the dog, and then within less than 3 minutes, I discovered why. The first thing they taught you to do with your dog, you have them on a leash, and with your right hand, the dog is on your left side. With your right hand, you grab this on a choke chain.
Yeah.
You jerk up on their neck with the choke chain. With your right hand, push down on their rear end with the left hand and tell them, sit. That's how they taught you to train the dog. Yeah. It took a nanosecond to discover why I had the muzzle on my own dog. He didn't want to sit at that moment and let me know in uncertain terms. I would have been severely injured if I hadn't had a muzzle on the dog. But here's the piece, and it still has impact on my life today. I had never seen a dog that didn't sit. I was raised with a dog. We had always had a dog in the house as a kid. I'd never seen a dog that didn't do naturally everything they wanted me to train that dog to do. So after these training sessions with this sergeant trainer, I would come back on my own time. I'd take the dog out in the field, and we'd just walk around with the dog on the leash. When I would stop and the dog would sit, I'd say, "Good boy, sit." When the dog would alert, you know, ears up because somebody else was coming, I would say, "Good boy, watch him." When the dog went for somebody, I'd say, "Good boy, get him." Everything I needed that dog to do, it did naturally. I just started developing the dog to do it when I wanted, not by force, simply out of the relationship with the dog. Now, take that into the work I'm doing now. Leading Change Without Resistance is the new book I'm working on. And it's really...
Sorry, I still have more questions because I just find this fascinating. So, you know, I've tried to train a couple dogs. And in hindsight, I know my mistakes I made with both the dogs. I didn't know this would turn into a dog training conversation, but hey, we'll go with it. So I guess my first question is, why is the dog fully grown when you're getting to him? Because shouldn't you be doing the bonding with the dog when they're 0 to 6 months?
No, they didn't even start. That's typical. They don't start canine training till they're at least a year. And their reason is that they have to get through that puppy stage.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I've done it myself now with my own personal dogs, starting much younger. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So how long were you in the military doing dog training?
Like 3 years, 5 months, 26 days.
But who's counting? No one's counting.
But who's counting?
So then what did you do when you got out?
I went back to Germany. They wouldn't let me. I had a bar in Germany. I talked myself into a bar for a dollar and a quarter.
Okay. And there's another why question there. Why or how? So you can pick which one.
No, I don't know. We'll, maybe some other time we'll talk. But bottom line, they wouldn't let me. They wouldn't discharge you in Germany. You had to go back to the States to be discharged. So I went back for a couple of weeks, saw my old friends, got on a plane, and flew back to Germany to run the bar. It was very boring. And after a short period of time, I ran into an old friend there in Germany. And, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm hitchhiking around the world." I said, "You're kidding. Let's go have a beer." So that night, I said, "Well, why are you here back in this town with the Air Force base if you're going around the world?" He says, "Oh, the guy I was traveling with had to go home for an emergency. So I'm deciding whether or not I want to go home or go the rest of the way around the world." I said, "So what do you need to make the difference?" He said, "Well, I don't want to do it alone. So what would it take for me to go with you?" This is 10 o'clock at night. The next day, I packed up everything that wouldn't fit, bought a backpack, packed up everything that wouldn't fit in the backpack, and the following morning at 5 a.m., we began hitchhiking. I did it for about 18 months.
And what did you learn at the end of that trip?
So many different things about people because I experienced them in so many different ways. Number one, I sewed an American flag on the outside of my backpack. So when we hitchhiked with the backpack with American flag facing out. Now, important piece in here. This is 1965, 66. I would not even consider doing that today. So, you know. But the way we hitchhiked is Barry, my friend, would get on one side of the road, I'd get on the other, and we'd hitchhike in both directions. And whoever got the first ride, that's where we went that day.
I love it. You couldn't do that now if you wanted. I love that you were able to do that.
We were back and forth in so many places, got all the way into the Middle East. Barry's goal, Barry was Jewish. Barry's goal was he wanted to work on a kibbutz in Israel. That was the goal. So we get to Israel, and there's so many stories. I'm writing this, by the way, for my grandkids, because there are a lot of stories behind in here. And we were picking – here I am from Florida picking oranges in Israel.
So
–
go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, just real quickly. At lunch one day, Barry says, let's go. There's 2-hour lunch break, and it's pretty European and Eastern, you know, long break. So let's go. And I thought, well, okay, let's go. And I thought he meant back to work. And he says, no, let's go home. We packed up our backpacks, hitchhiked to the port in Haifa, Israel, and started the journey back and hitchhiked on a freighter on our way back to the States.
It's almost like he achieved his goal. He was done. Like, that's it. I'm over.
Well, that was it for him, and it was time for me too. 18 months was a pretty long time. But yeah, I learned so many things. I learned, number one, to respect a lot of different points of view and listen to people and hear their perspectives and to understand. And because we would go to the universities, Syria, in Damascus.
Yeah.
And we would go to the student unions in the universities. And Barry had a tape recorder. By then it was, you know, about that big, but he carried it. And we would interview the students to understand their point of view about Americans, about Jews, etc. That was part of Barry's learning.
How fascinating.
You know what?
Yeah.
Nothing has changed. In 50 some years, the same rhetoric is still spoken as to the issues.
That's fascinating. I would imagine from a historical standpoint, just what an incredible moment in time for you, right? But when you come back, you're on this, I mean, your parents may have thought you were dead at this point. I have no idea. You're gone for 18 months. But as you get off the ship or the plane, however you got back, where are you at in your mind? Like, okay, because you've got to be, what, 27, 28 at this point?
No, 20, actually about 25.
25.
Yeah.
So do you just buck up and start working?
Yes.
So what was the first job you had after the military?
My mom worked in a department store, and one of the part-timers was a full-time at a large insurance company. And I got hired by the insurance company as a claims adjuster through that reference.
That's awesome. And how long did you last at that job?
Thanks you for your terminology there, because that is – it's 2 years – and then I moved to Colorado. There's so many little side stories here. I hope you're editing because what happened was I went by the insurance office one day and I saw my buddy's car parked out front. So I didn't want to go in because somebody might give me something to do. So I called him and said, what are you doing for lunch? And he says, oh, I can't talk right now. Write down this address and I'll meet you there. So I drive to this office building. He pulls in and I said, what are we doing here? This is an office building. I thought we're going to lunch. He says, I'm interviewing for a job. Do you remember Manny? Manny used to work with us here, and he's got a new job, and he called to see if I wanted to work in his new company. So I'm going in to get interviewed. If you don't mind coming in and waiting for a few minutes, I go in, sit in the lobby while he goes to get interviewed. He and Manny come out, and Manny says, you know, this isn't going to work for Greg. Greg was his name. This isn't going to work for Greg. Why don't you interview while you're here? I had no idea where I was or why I was there. So I went in and got – this has happened to me so many times throughout my life. So I go in and walk out of that building for lunch with a new job doing site evaluations and assessments for a new, rapidly growing franchise restaurant company. Flying all over the country. There were weeks that I flew. You've heard of like 100,000 miles a year?
Yeah.
There were weeks that I was flying between 5 and 7,000 miles in a week.
Wow.
That got me to Denver. I landed in Denver at 10 a.m. one morning. I flew out at 5 p.m. the same day and said, this is home. And I've been here. June 1 was my 47th anniversary.
What about Denver?
Mountains.
coming from a guy from Florida, I guess that makes some sense.
Well, the other thing I learned in Germany was there was no seasons in Miami. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I learned season change. And the place I was stationed, and believe me, walking outdoors in the middle of the night, midnight to 8 a.m. shift, 40 degree below zero wind chill factor, walking around nuclear uploaded aircraft with a German Shepherd at the end of the leash. That's how I learned about climate change.
Yeah.
And season change. Yeah. So I got back to Miami. It was boring.
Yeah.
So I got to Denver and said, this is home. Took me a year to pull it off.
So then, you know, not to, obviously we can't go year by year, or we'll be here till probably tomorrow. But so speed this up a little bit. So like your career path, so you're married, you have kids, right? You have grandkids.
Now, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So how, like in Denver, but what were you doing there for majority of your time? Or did you keep having these serendipitous moments of like transition, door open, transition?
Yes, the transition piece. Now here, so let's fast forward.
Yeah.
So I come back, the job I thought I might be able to get when I got here fell through. So I went back to the insurance company. And because I had a history, they hired me. Lunch one day at their corporate headquarters, regional headquarters, ended my association with corporate America. And I went, came home that night very disturbed.
What happened?
The conversation around the lunch table went like this. That the lunch that ended my corporate career. That's the chapter title, by the way, in the person book for I'm writing for pass on to grandkids. The conversation was, what did you watch last night? And someone said, oh, I watched this. And someone else around the table said, wait a minute. That was a repeat. Didn't you see it the first time? And the response to that question ended my corporate career. The response was, yeah, I saw it the first time, but there was nothing else on I wanted to watch. This was not a world I wanted to spend my life in.
Is that
someone?
But do you think that would have happened if you hadn't traveled for 18 months?
Possibly not. Yeah, I mean, I can only speculate. But I went upstairs, had dinner with my friend, and I said, I'm getting out of there. She says, what are you going to do? And this now links to what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm going to open a record store. She said, that was the first thing that came to mind. No prior thought. I had never been in retail. I knew nothing about the record business, knew nothing about business itself. And 5 weeks to the day later, with only a $1,500 signature loan, I opened the first record store and became a hippie. in 1974. And here's the piece that links now. Because I didn't know what I was doing, I had to live in a constant state of figuring it out because I didn't know. So because I had no inventory, $1,500 included the lumber to make the cabinets, the shelves, the racks, used cash register. I had no inventory. So when someone, and this is where unlearning comes in, someone comes in the door, looks around, they're on their way back out. The most useless question in the world that ranks at the bottom of what the whales leave behind in retail is, can I help you? No, thank you. I was just looking. So I had to figure out another question to engage them in a conversation. The question I came up with was, were you looking for something you couldn't find? I could guarantee I'd get a yes. I had nothing. So I said, if I could have it here for you tomorrow evening by 5 o'clock, and I gave you $1 off, would you pay me for it now? And they just look at me and say, you could have it tomorrow evening and you'll give me $1 off? And I'd say, and I'd pick up the phone and dial a local distributor. Denver is in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. So it's a big distribution point for a number of states. I'd get on the phone, call a distributor, locate what they wanted, have them hold it for me and say yes. And then I would ring them up. And on the back of a business card, I would write paid for and the name of the album. I was doing just in time decades before it became the big thing in manufacturing. Now, here's the other part. Other record owners would get up. They'd open at 10. They'd maybe crawl out of bed 9:15, drag themselves into their store. And every weekend, Friday, they would go pick up an order. I had to go to every distributor every morning. I was out of bed bright and early going around distributors to pick up things that I had ordered. So I had them the next day. But these people would come back and, well, wow, you know, here's a couple of other things I've been looking for. And that's how I built that business. I continually figured out what it would take. The second year in business, I did $300,000 in gross sales.
Holy cow. What is that today's dollars? Today's dollars, that's got to be $2-3 million?
It could be. Wow. And here's the thing. My third year, I had a second store. My fourth year, I opened a third store and got the purchase option on a 200-room hotel in downtown Denver, talked myself into it with no money, no background in the hotel business. It had two live music rooms, and that's how I talked myself into it, because they weren't bringing in the artist I wanted to hear. So after sufficient complaining, I got asked, if you think you could do better, you take over. Friday night, October 1, 1977, I took over this 200-room hotel with $60 that I had borrowed out of the cash register from a record store.
So how long were you in this type of field before you got out and started Unlearn?
9 years.
We got to quickly go through this. Then, what did you do next? Because now we're 9 years. We're like in like 1984, no, 86.
Oh yeah, no, you're right about there. You're real close. So one store got stolen. I mean, they backed up a truck and emptied all the inventory out of the store overnight. Jesus. And one was an employee that ripped me off. So I ended up closing two stores, and then there was just two partners, because the gentleman who helped me start out in the record business, I made a partner along the way. Mm-hmm. And the two of us were in this one little store driving each other crazy. So we took a quarter out of the cash register and flipped a coin to see who was going to go get something different to do.
You lost, huh?
Or won.
Half glass, half full, half empty. I like it.
You bet.
I like it.
So I kept the quarter, walked two blocks to the 7-Eleven, bought a newspaper, brought it back, and opened the want ads on the counter in the record store and started making calls. I got an interview and went to the interview and got hired.
But what happened to the hotel? So your partner took the hotel.
Oh no. You said this could take days. I thought that there was an investor who was going to put money in the hotel. Mm-hmm. I was the front guy, and I was told there's a lot of revealing here of my own naivety and not really knowing what I was doing. Please understand.
No, that's fine.
But a friend of a friend said, I know somebody who wants to purchase that hotel. They've got the money, but they don't know how to run it. Could you run it? Well, my answer to any question anybody ever asks me is, can you?
Yes.
Yes. Then you figure it out.
Yeah.
So the owner, who owned numerous properties in downtown Denver, comes in at 9 o'clock Monday morning to get his check. And comes in and says, I've got some good news for you and some bad news. And he says, well, what's the bad news? And I said, I don't have any money. The people who I thought were the investors changed their mind. They let us know yesterday. So here's Monday morning, 9 a.m., I have no money. He says, what could possibly be the good news? And this is an older, very wealthy gentleman. And I said, I think I can turn this place around. And he looks at me and says, I tell you what I'm going to do, young man. I'm going to give you 90 days to see what you can do, because I don't have any other choice. Under one condition, my grandson just graduated with an MBA from the Harvard School of Business. And he's always loved this property. This property, by the way, is historic register here in Denver. It's very well known. He says, if you don't mind him living on this property, so I have eyes on, I will give you 90 days to see what you can do. Da-da. So I'm in the office that afternoon. The desk clerk comes in and says, there's this weird guy outside here saying he wants to talk to King Krug. My last name, Krug. I'd never heard the expression King Krug. And I said, oh my God. So I come out and here's this guy, God's honest, standing there in a zoot suit. Do you ever watch the Dick Tracy cartoon movie?
Yes.
With the big lapels and a big ascot and a big thing and a fedora about this big around, standing there. This is the grandson.
Not what I envisioned coming from Harvard, by the way.
No. And he says, can we talk private? So we go in the office and he says, so tell me what you want to do here. And I told him, and he says, I'd like to help you. So let's see what we can come up with. And with his family name, we got to see anybody we wanted to in Denver. And we would get into presidents of banks. And I'm talking not just little bank. I'm talking banks all over the suburbs.
Yeah.
Banks. We would get in to see the president with his name, his family name. And then the president would say, would look at our one-page business plan asking for $10 million. And the question that inevitably came was, how long have you gentlemen been in the hotel business? And the answer was counting today. we're at 17 days. So they would give us a referral to go talk to somebody else. And then at one point, one of the people who was not a banker, it was an heir of a lot of Texas oil money, young man, about our age, said, I want to buy you out. I'll buy your purchase. See, I had a purchase option on the hotel, so anybody had to go through me. And then someone else who was a private investor came and said, no, I want to buy your purchase option. So I just got the two of them negotiating against each other and sold the purchase option to the highest bidder. I was there in the hotel business 110 days, and I made more money in 110 days than the last 3 years combined.
And that's, I mean, do you think that that's just luck? Like, that's just luck? Like, you were there, or?
No.
No? You don't? Do you believe in luck?
Do things just happen because you're lucky? I believe we cause everything that happens to us, that there are no coincidences, that there's a place that when we live from a particular place, that life works. It's supposed to work. We're supposed to live from a place of joy, fulfillment, satisfaction, and happiness. And that's another big part of the unlearning, is to get ourselves back. It's not a doing, it's a being. Mm. And again, now to look at the work I do in leadership development, I don't train. Training will never be effective in the field of leadership, because it isn't a do, it's a come from. The most effective leaders, the ones who people would do anything for, it isn't because of what they knew. It's because of their hearts and how they showed up in what they do. And by the way, Greg's Lavore is one of the finest models of that I've ever met. You were, if you didn't know it, were really honored with getting to spend the time with Greg. He's an amazing man. So, no, I do believe we create our luck out of, and this is something that is so missing right now on our planet, is integrity, personal integrity, living from a place of integrity and what can I do, not what can I get.
Mm-hmm. So,
and that right now.
Because you're starting to go down this path that actually kind of dovetails to a new segment I have. So if you listen to Greg's interview, I did the Fast Five. And yes. I actually just started a new segment. So you are my second guinea pig. So this new segment is about being authentic. So are you ready to get authentic?
Brace yourself.
All right. Well, no, these are good questions. So question one, how do you work on becoming more self-aware?
By telling myself the truth.
Okay.
And being willing to listen to others. The business partner I work with most recently, we had some amazing conversations and it wasn't out of here's what's wrong with you. It's do you notice? And by being willing to listen, being comfortable enough with self, being okay enough with self to not need to protect and defend, allows someone to hear something coming from the outside. But one of my frequent questions that I ask myself with is, what haven't you told yourself the truth about today?
And so for you, it's about practice, right? You practice listening. You practice asking yourself the right questions to constantly test if you are aware of your personal being. Does that make sense?
I'm very sensitive language-wise.
Yeah.
So
it's I'm not so sorry.
No, it's the word practice. Is I live from that place. I practice that as a part of my living, not from, oh, it's 7:15. I need to practice this for 15 minutes.
Okay, fair enough.
It's being, and it is a self-awareness, a deep level of self-awareness.
So how do you work with people who don't seem to have that attribute? Because I feel like you would see that with a lot of leaders.
Oh my God. I could mention one right now. And another little piece of terminology, having a title does not make somebody a leader.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
A leader is someone who is effective in producing results toward a shared desired outcome with others. And having a title sometimes is the biggest obstacle to achieving that.
I feel like we see that. I think we're seeing that at the governmental level at this point. So
the highest level.
Yeah.
In that arena.
Yeah.
So how do you work with them?
Mm-hmm.
The first thing, and this is what's different with the work that I do, is the first step in the work is to totally transform people's relationships with themselves so that they are viewing themselves through a different lens. And by viewing themselves through the lens of not needing to protect and defend, by simply being able to be present, the term that we use for this is AMP, how to amp up your results, increase your results. Awareness, the A. M is mindfulness, and the P is presence, being present in the moment.
That's awesome. So I need to keep moving along here. So we'll come back around to all this. Question two, how are you honest with yourself and others? Like, what role does honesty play?
It's paramount.
So how
absolutely
do you do it?
Paramount. Well, it's... And by the way, it's not as an exercise, and this is another thing about practice. It's telling the truth and even telling the truth to others. It's being willing to listen and not judge. It's willing to trust that a good friend of mine has a term called assume positive intent.
Sounds like living my wife.
Assuming that the other person is doing the best they can. Mm-hmm. And from that starting place, the other is not stepping over crap, that if something needs to be done, doing it. And I mean, I just picked up two things on the sidewalk that just to throw away. I think one of the biggest signs of the lack of integrity right now is how people handle their grocery carts in the grocery store. That how one of the places that I go, there are two different sizes. One is black and one is white. So you don't even have to know the sizes, the color. And people will go and leave their cart, take their bag out, and leave it in front of the wrong size. Now, it's the piece that's missing perhaps is it's not about the cart. It's the level that they're selling out to their own integrity on life.
But I want to go back to honesty. Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. I'm just trying to be focused here on this. So for you, and we'll come full circle on these questions, but for you, the role of honesty, not only is it paramount, But you have to be precise, clear, and kind in delivering that honest feedback. At the same time, you have to be willing to listen to that honest feedback without your personal bias and filters.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I got that. Then.
There's no such thing as thank you for your term, languaging. You used the term feedback, not criticism. Mm-hmm. There is absolutely nothing constructive in criticism.
Yeah.
There's no value whatsoever in criticizing somebody or something. There is value in engaging in a discussion or conversation about in a form of feedback. So that is entirely different.
For me, that is always something I've always struggled with because I grew up in a house that feedback was criticism. And so I perpetuated that. And my wife is amazing. And she and all of her siblings, her grandparents, her grandfather really believed in Dale Carnegie. And they all went through Dale Carnegie training. And so, I mean, everyone, like every single grandchild, great-grandchildren will go through it if they want. Like he believes in it that strongly. And so she's always like, I always start from a positive perspective, right? And I always think of the negative, like they're trying to screw me. And she's really good at giving feedback because she thinks of the positive first. And I'm always like direct to the point of what's negative. And so it's something that I'm working on that I've learned from her because I have a very good eye for shortcomings, right? Like here's the gap in what you're doing. Here's what you could do better. But my phrasing isn't, especially probably with her, isn't always the best. But I acknowledge it. And it's something that I'm really trying to work on to get better at. You know, it's a tough skill.
I'll send you a white paper that I did that you might find helpful.
Yeah, please.
In that, and a mailing address. I'll send you the copy of the latest book,
okay.
The Missing Piece in Leadership.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. All right. So question three. So this is quite the opposite of my fast five, by the way. Question three. How do you use compassion or empathy in your work?
I couldn't do it without.
Is that a starting point for you?
Yes. Yes. See, and again, working with a team, every team I work with is exactly the right team of people. That's my starting place. Now, I've gotten called in by CEOs of companies that I know you've heard the name of, be willing to bet within 48 hours, who had called HR and said, I want you to replace my whole executive team. These are the wrong people. Met with the CEO, talked him into giving me a week of 5 half-days. I only work with teams in half-day segments. Of half-day segments, at the end of the week, nobody was left. Nobody left. He discovered he had the right people. One of the big challenges in the way was the CEO. The other challenge in the way was they redesigned their whole org chart. Rather than trying to fit people into boxes on an org chart, they created a whole new org chart based on the competencies of the people he had. But that's empathy. I mean, I start from that understanding. And also that, again, that people are doing the best they can.
So how do you practice it? I mean, do you practice? Wrong word. How do you live it? To use your vernacular, how do you live it? Like just throughout the day?
Well, it's just so I wouldn't even know how to answer that because
it's who you are.
It's so much a part of me. It's who I am. Okay. I couldn't imagine doing it any other way.
Great. Okay. So question four, how do you relate? I need to think of a better way to phrase this question. Again, you're only my second person, so I'm still working on the questioning here. But how do you relate to the most junior person or lowest level person in an organization and the C-suite? What tools do you use to relate to both the top and bottom of the organization?
Oh, questions.
Curiosity,
and conversation.
Maybe? Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Mm. Curiosity is one of the questions that I really apologize. One of the questions that I ask when I work with an executive team is to describe the best leader they've ever had. What are the traits, competencies that leader brought? It took 25 years for one term to show up on that list. 25 years. And when it did, I was speechless because I had never thought of it. And the term missing for 25 years describing a leader was curiosity. Mm. 25 years. So that, because so many people with titles think they're the ones who have it all. They have the answers.
That's a common mistake. In fact, I find the best leaders are the ones who realize they know the least.
Yes.
You know? So, okay, question
the
five.
The one who can draw the best answers.
Yeah. So question five. Sorry. Because we're at an hour and 2 minutes at this point. So question five, and I have an interview in about 25 minutes. Question five, what was the question? Oh, what role does – and I forgot. What role does – this is so normal. What role does learning play in your daily life and in your career?
It's constant. Mm. It's a constant and that's part of not thinking you already have it figured out. It's constant. Mm-hmm. Constant. It's a state of being. It's a come from. Mm. It's part of that mindfulness and presence of mind to be always open to listening and learning.
So thank you.
There's finish. There's one. There's no finish line on learning. Mm. That's one of the issues. People who think they've got it figured out. The moment they think they've got it figured out, they're already wrong.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. See, I didn't get that type of stuff from my parents. I had to kind of evolve. I'm sure same as you. Yeah. So thank you for being authentic. And the reason why I started doing this segment is, you know, I actually have a book coming out in the spring. And the book is 90 Executives on Authentic Leadership. And so it all comes from these podcasts that I've done talking to these various leaders. And these themes that I've kind of brought up there – or what I found when I started talking to these leaders again and again. And then I found out, did some work and saw that people are already writing about this. But I didn't even know this existed, authentic leadership. Like I just in my head, you know, I'm a marketing professional, not a leadership guy. But I wanted to be leadership in my PhD program, longer story. I ended up being marketing. And so I started like bouncing this idea off. And the one thing I don't ask, but it comes up in our conversation is that it's really my belief that the best leaders go through some of the biggest crucibles, right? And those crucibles are what help define, change, transform their own personal perspective to create a higher level of self-awareness. And going through that, like you, and I think like myself, that allowed me to be more honest, more compassionate or have empathy, and to relate to people from the top and bottom. And then I kind of argue that, and when you get to this point, what really keeps driving you is the desire to learn, not only about yourself, but about others, other topics, other organizations. And so by going through that crucible, it ends up driving you to be more authentic no matter what, if you're open to the process. And so not to plug my book in the middle of my own podcast, but that happens to be what the book is about, which is why I find this conversation fascinating, because this is kind of what you're already doing in your organization of Unlearn, right?
The Institute. Yes.
So the last five or so minutes, let's talk about this Unlearn, the book you have coming out. I don't know if we can cover all this in 5 minutes, but we'll do our best. What would you like to start with, Unlearn or the book? You can choose.
Well, I'll start with this.
Yeah.
Though I have not gone to college.
Doesn't matter.
I have three. I taught for 15 years in the MBA program of a major university, Johns Hopkins. I taught the last three credit hours of a major MBA program at Johns Hopkins for 15 years.
And let me go on record by saying this, by the way. I don't think you have to have an education to teach. I think you have to have lived a life to have learned to get that information. I think there's a huge misnomer in the States about what an education means. I know I shouldn't say that because I have a PhD, but I don't think it's necessary for everybody. And I think that you're a great example of somebody's whose life was dramatic and engaging and transformative and brought you to a point that no education is going to teach you, only life. And so I think that's so awesome. So I want to give you that compliment because I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. So the typical work that we do is an organization that has gotten to a place that they know there's something that isn't working. They've tried everything else. They've tried all the big names and all of and they're still not getting the results they want. So, and I went for almost 20 years without making any outgoing sales calls, to give you a sense. It was all referrals. And usually it was somebody who shares with a friend that, oh my God, we're stuck on this. We don't know what to do. And I've worked on $6 billion projects with three federal agencies that reported to 11 congressional committees almost daily, to give you a sense. Yeah. Executive teams throughout corporate America as well.
So what makes yours unique compared to other people's, you think, your process?
What's unique is that I don't go in with the answers. Mm-hmm. I go in with the questions and engage them in coming up. The basic premise is, whose good ideas are people most likely to buy into with the least resistance?
Their own. Yeah.
And the typical approach organizations take when they're stuck is bring some expert in who sounds like they've got a good idea. Mm-hmm. Then they come in and tell people, here's how you should do it. And instead, what we come in is guide them through conversations, and they discover them for themselves, mm-hmm. what they need to do and their reasons for doing it. And the biggest part is the trust that develops between the people on that team mm-hmm. in a very short time. Mm-hmm. And then while we're guiding them through this learning, at the same time, for example, that team I shared, $6 billion project, mm-hmm. they couldn't stand to be in the room with each other. No, seriously.
Yeah.
These are 2 3-stars and a 1-star. So we're talking high rank. And so after every issue that they resolved, we debrief them on how were you able to resolve that when you've been messing with it for months. And they shared. So when they finished that time with them, they had not only figured out their biggest issues, but they had learned their own methodology for how they're going to continue to deal with mm-hmm. issues when they come up in the future.
So I want to interject because there's a really interesting question. You say you come in with the questions, and I know history is probably giving you this answer, but when you first started doing this, how did you know what questions to ask?
Well, curiosity. Hmm. What do you need to know to go forward? Like, for example, what do I need to know about the relationships between the people in the room? Hmm. Is a very typical question, because meeting with each individual on a C-suite one-on-one before they all come together is, what do I need to know about the other people on this team? And
that's
it tells
awesome.
You everything.
Yeah, you're getting their perception of the other people.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
And if you were in charge, what would be the first 2 or 3 things you would do? And when you listen to that from the individuals, you get a sense of actually where the obstacles are. And then when you get them in the room, it's – and like that $6 billion project, I met with each individual one-on-one. They kept saying, what are we going to do when we get together? You know, and I'd say, well, let's wait till that happens. And truth is, I didn't know the question I was going to ask when I walked in that room that mm-hmm. first morning until I got in that room. Yeah. And the question that I asked, and we're talking huge, huge project, the first question I asked was, if after getting to know you people one-on-one, I told you I don't think there's a chance in hell you could ever learn how to work well together, what would have brought me to that conclusion?
That's awesome.
And then you just got to smile.
And just sit back and wait.
It took an hour and 45 minutes to get it.
That is fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a process of trusting, mm-hmm. and it's by trusting, it gets them to start trusting, by modeling trusting. And I more than once have said, I'm not sure where to go from here. Who's got an idea? And one of the most underutilized things in any of this work is silence, being willing to be silent, to be willing to wait for the answer.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because that's actually sometimes, and I have one more question after this to wrap up, but that's one of the tools that I'll use sometimes in my interviews. Well, I'll ask kind of a hard question that's uncomfortable, and then I'll just kind of wait. And then I just wait for them to say something, and that kind of opens the dialogue with them about whatever it is. I've had people on who have been raped, abused. These are leaders, like professional people in the world, highly successful, come from drug families, were addicts themselves, like all sorts of great stories from a content perspective. But from a personal perspective, it took me asking the hard questions and waiting, you know, 20 seconds, 30 seconds in an interview, that could be deafening. So Doug, last question I have for you, and then I'm going to let you run and do your life. Doug, for where you're at in your life, how do you define happiness?
It's looking for it. It's everywhere.
I love the simplicity of that.
That's how we're supposed to live our lives. Enjoy. And all we got to do is keep finding it. It's everywhere.
Well, Doug Krug, Institute for Unlearning, I thank you for your time, your energy, and your I've enjoyed all of your stories, and I feel like I only got about 10%.